Welcome to this episode of the China Horizons Politics Podcast. Today we'll dive into the complex and fascinating story of China's transformation on the occasion of the People's Republic of China's 75 years anniversary here on October 1st, 2024. My name is Kasper Ingemann Beck. I'm a researcher at Copenhagen Business School. I'm joined today by the two coordinators of DRAC and Reconnect China, which are the two core Horizon Europe projects, which builds Europe's future China capacity. The two esteemed professors are Bart De Zijn, professor at Department of Languages and Cultures at Ghent University in Belgium. Bart, he focuses on modern and contemporary history of China, Chinese political philosophy and new Confucianism. And I'm also joined by Professor Kjell-Erik Brødskov, professor at the Copenhagen Business School, professor of China Studies. He's an international recognized authority on China's political economy, including the party-state relations and the Communist Party of China's role in the modernization process. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
From a struggling post-revolutionary state in 1949 to an economic powerhouse and global superpower, China's journey has really been marked by many critical junctures and bold reforms. Today, we'll try to explore some of these. So I'd like to start already at the very beginning, on October 1st, 1949, where the communist leader Mao Zedong declared the creation of People's Republic of China. Kjell-Erik Brødskov, how would you describe China at that moment in history?
It was a very poor China, peasant China. It wasn't an industrialized society. It wasn't what Marx had anticipated when he talked about the world revolution. According to Marx, those revolutions would take place in highly industrialized countries, and China was certainly not a highly industrialized country in 1949. Actually, China was more backward than Russia in 1917. In terms of a long range of categories, number of industrial workers, productivity and production capacity in steel production, in oil production, in all kinds of heavy industry capabilities, but also in terms of food, corn, grain per capita, China was really very poor. So when China introduced a Soviet, a Stalinist development strategy in 1949, in the 50s, in the form of five-year plans, it was actually rather dysfunctional. And impatient Mao thought it didn't work too well, so he introduced the Great Leap Forward, which was, of course, a disaster. So, to sum up, it was a very poor Communist Party that took over China in 1949, a very backward, peasant-based China without this, necessary, really, background for industrialization.
Thank you, Kjell-Erik. So what were some of the achievements then in during this period, those 27 years of reform? Bart, what did Mao actually move during those years? Where did China progress?
Well, as Kjell-Erik just explained, China was economically speaking lacking behind the Soviet Union. And much, of course, was also because, well, of the past about 100 years of history. I mean, China had experienced one revolution, one uprising, war and civil war after the other, which was, of course, very detrimental to the economic buildup, which also explains why in 1950, Mao Zedong decided to sign an agreement with the Soviet Union for economic help. And as just also mentioned, the Great Leap Forward, which was a great catastrophe, led to the stopping. Soviet Union withdrew actually its help, and well, China was to a large extent on its own. This also explains why actually through its first five-year plans, China tried to develop a first industrial revolution, one could say, using the resources that were locally available. And so this has led to the creation of a urban type of industrialization with important industrial cities. They really were, chosen because of the locally present raw materials. We also see that in the very first years of the People's Republic of China, there indeed was some economic advancement, both in industrial output and in agricultural output. But then, of course, China, after more than 100 years of havoc, had regained, let's say, its independence. And also this, of course, has to be taken into account in the economic rise of the moment. Most likely, I would say, in hindsight, had much more to do than really with the sophisticated program for economic development.
Yes, Kaleek, you want to step in here with the...
I think that it's very important to note that what took place in the 50s, what Mao and his colleagues in the top of the Chinese Communist Party, what they introduced, that development strategy they introduced in China in the 50s with a focus on heavy industry, a focus on investment. That industrialization strategy or development strategy has dominated or characterized the Chinese economic development ever since. Although there has been attempt to change this strategy significantly during the early 60s between the fiasco of the Great Leap Forward and the outbreak of the Cultural Revolution, where Deng Xiaoping and Chen Yun, they tried to introduce economic development strategy that was more focused on readjustment and reform, but they failed because Mao came back and called them revisionist and purged them. And after that, after the Cultural Revolution, and again, you know, it was the reintroduction, actually the reinforcement of that development strategy, focusing on heavy industry, focusing on investment, high investment. And there's been a persistent discussion in Chinese economic journals about the need to lower investment, but they never succeeded. And there's also been a persistent discussion about maybe shifting more to away from heavy industry and focus also on light industry and agriculture, but it was never really possible. So what Xi Jinping actually inherited in 2012 was a China, you know, which had been for many years characterized by heavy investment and heavy industrial development, resulting in overcapacity, and that is what we are dealing with today. So I just want to say that they put in place in the 50s this development strategy, which has been dominating very much ever since, although there has been attempt to change it.
Yeah, and to some extent you can say this also created the foundation for the growth that followed after Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening up in 1978, in the sense that you created state capacity to implement some of these reforms. You had an economy where you actually, you can say, you united China, you have one language, everyone receives some basic education, you have bureaucrats who could run some type of organizations. You did have corruption, but not to an extent where it destroyed the country. So there were elements put in place that were important for the following decades of economic growth. So let's also try to look a little bit at when Mao Zedong, he died in 76. But how would you characterize China at that moment in history? What type of China did he actually leave behind? And what was the ambition going forward from that moment of the Communist Party?
When indeed Mao Zedong died in September 76, there was, as has just been mentioned, this kind of a focus on heavy industry. When Deng Xiaoping launched his four modernizations, and the first modernization was also modernization of the industry, the policies of Deng Xiaoping have, of course, only been possible, I would say, given the fundamentally changed international context. In the times of Mao Zedong, the PRC was not recognized by the majority of the Western world, and it is only in the 70s, also with the accession of the People's Republic to the United Nations, that it was then recognized also by Western countries as, you know, the sovereign nation state representing China in the international bodies. And this has opened the possibility, of course, to start with joint ventures and to gradually also bring in technologies. So to divert the economy further from this mere focus on heavy industry. But I would say also that if we even go further on to the 80s, that one of the elements that helps to explain why China has become such an important economic player on the global scene now is its focus. It has also had on building up infrastructure, steel, concrete, and so on, which are, of course, also, let's say, traditionally can categorize them as heavy industries. So the industrial apparatus that had been built up in the pre-Deng Xiaoping period has also been instrumental in the sense that it was also very much instrumentalized in helping the country to look for connections and collaborations, economically speaking, with the Western world. And this is, of course, what has, to a very high extent, helped to explain the current economic position of China. Added to that, and this has to do, again, once that China became a part, let's say, of the global world, that in the very beginning of its development, 70s or late 70s, 80s, even also 90s, China could profit from a huge population and low wages, which have turned it into what is then commonly called the factory of the world.
Yes, thank you, Bart. I very much agree that the industrial foundation was important. I also think that we should remember at that time in history, China was a heavily rural economy. Most of the population lived in small cities, were farming in the local communes. So the agricultural reforms that moved labor into industry, into the cities, that hired productivity of the economy, so moving labor from low productivity to high productivity parts of the economy, were super important. And another thing I want to mention is that, and building on the ideas of Kelleek just a moment ago, China never went through this kind of shock therapy where the state were removed from the economy, as you saw in the former Soviet Union and so on. And Kelleek, maybe you can elaborate on that part.
Yes, but let me first say that when you asked the question, what kind of China did we have in 1976 when Mao died in September 1976? What kind of China was that? Well, it was a very self-sufficient China, Zili Gongsheng, a China that was inward-looking and not integrated in the world, certainly not in economic sense. Foreign trade at the time was around 4% of GDP, very, very low. It was a China that looked inwards, and that was Mao's line, whereas Deng Xiaoping introduced something new. He introduced an open China, a China opening up. And I think that there are these two important strands in Chinese history, the China that is inward-looking and the China that is opening up. You saw also in the Ming Dynasty with Zheng He traveling, a China opening up, but that was closed down again. So Deng Xiaoping made this historic contribution of opening up China, and I think that is probably his major contribution. A poor China still, for those of us who went to China to study in the late 70s, we really experienced it. There were no free markets. Everything was state-run. Restaurants were state-run. They closed at 7:30 sharp, and you were thrown out. No international hotels in Beijing. They turned off the light at night, so it's pitch dark. That was old China. Everything was rationed, you know, and you couldn't move from the countryside to the city because you were not entitled to ration coupons. And without ration coupons, you just could not exist. But it was a heavily regulated China, and very much to the detriment of the rural population, of the peasants. The peasants were actually paying for this heavy industrial development strategy, siphoning off resources from agriculture that went to industry, where industrial products were priced high and agriculture products low. So there was this transfer of resources. And that sort of changed, and you're mentioning the reforms in the early 80s. And in the beginning of the 80s, what contributed most to economic growth was actually agriculture. But that changed then later on from the mid-80s and through the 90s. It was, again, industry. And there was this attempt maybe to reorient the economy, the strategy, but I would argue that that never really succeeded in a major transformation of the development strategy. And we can return to whether this is happening now, but for many years it didn't.
Yes, because following these liberal reforms, the creation of stock markets, the creation of market for products, the deindustrialization and so on, then we had decades of relatively stable, high two digits growth. Entering from 2012, we're entering the Xi Jinping era. And what is Xi Jinping's project now with these decades of growth and liberalization seem to be ending? What is Xi Jinping's project now?
Well, Xi Jinping, in some aspects, is following up on what his predecessor, Hu Jintao, has done. For instance, when we see the very slogan of Deng Xiaoping saying in the mid-80s, let some people get rich first, which indeed happened. But one of the results of these policies was that the, let's say, the difference, the discrepancy between poor and rich in China has been increasing dramatically. And it was necessary to have some adjustments to that. And this basically already set under the previous presidency with Hu Jintao and Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, who started redistributing wealth. And this is important, of course, to maintain stability. Social, economic stability is important for any country, so also for China. And we see that one of the policy lines of Mr. Xi is the same. He's further getting into the redistribution of wealth. And you can also see that, of course, in public announcements he makes, you know, or in government documents, how the concept of stability is, domestic stability is a very important element. So this, I would say, is on the domestic level, one of his priority lines. On an international level, I think it is characteristic for every great power that they are looking for influence. With economic influence comes also other influence. And we can see that in many of the initiatives that have been taken by, among others, Xi Jinping, but also there he is continuing in the line of his predecessors. For instance, in 2001, the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which first started off as a kind of a security structure, but has increasingly become an economic and a political collaboration structure. And this, or the expansion of the BRICS and to BRICS Plus, and these are all signs that China's importance on the global scene is also increasing. So this is, I would say, another line of development we see happening.
Yes, that, I very much agree with that. On the other hand, you also have people arguing that you see an end of the reform and opening up period now. This is something different. We're stepping into a new era. It's not reform and opening up. It's not liberalization of markets anymore. It is a different type of project. What project is that, Kjell Erik Bosgaard?
Yes, it is different. I mean, you see, for example, that there's no longer talk about separation of party and government. This was something Deng Xiaoping promoted in the 80s, actually already in 1980. He repeated that in 1986, separation of government and party, that the party should not get involved in everything. The party should step back and let government do its business. And associated with that, Deng Xiaoping also introduced the Carter reform, limits on how long you in your position as governor or vice governor or minister, only 2 times 5 years, 2 terms. And that has also been changed by Xi Jinping. So Xi Jinping has reverted or has changed or has backpedaled on many of those reforms that Deng Xiaoping was introducing in order, and that was explicit, in order to prevent a new Mao from emerging, in order to prevent a new dictator from emerging in the Chinese Communist Party. These reforms were put in place in the 80s, and Xi Jinping, he is taking them off the table, and he has a completely different agenda, an agenda which is about recentralization, an agenda which is about strengthening the Chinese Communist Party. And in that sense, he's actually different from Mao, because Mao, he was almost destroying the Chinese Communist Party during the Cultural Revolution. But Xi Jinping is strengthening the Chinese Communist Party in all aspects. He's introducing party cells in all organizations, companies, even joint ventures, all have to have a party cell. So there is this campaign of party building going on. And all this is something, and I think that is a very good expression, seeing Xi Jinping as some kind of organizational emperor. He's not an emperor who can rule at will. His power is related to or stems from the Chinese Communist Party. He's not a Putin. I mean, he's got institutions. Putin doesn't have institutions. But Xi Jinping does have institutions. He meets with the Politburo. He meets in the Standing Committee. He meets with the Central Committee. And here, he's a little bit different from Deng Xiaoping, who very rarely went to Politburo meetings. But Xi Jinping is strengthening these institutions of power, of centralization. And he's, in that sense, not a political reformer. And he's certainly also not an economic reformer. In 2013, he put forward this these reform proposals. There were 300 of them. Many of them have actually, most of them have not been implemented. And again, the third plenum this summer, again, around 300 reform proposals. And when you look at them in detail, they're very much sort of tinkering with the system. You don't find really major fundamental reform. And he is not interested in that because that would destroy his power base. He's interested in state control. And behind the state, you have the party. So when you look at the economy today, you don't see a weakening of the state-owned enterprises. Actually, you see a strengthening of the state-owned enterprises, of the big SOEs. Strategic sectors of the economy still dominated by the big SOEs, not by private companies. And that is a clear trend at the moment. You can have mixed ownership, but at the basis, the core of the economy is still state-owned companies.
Yes, and I also think in addition to that is some people have noted that this is the rise of party law in the sense that you are not deinstitutionalizing and personalizing power. It's not random rule. It is very detailed law-based governance of the economy, but law-based in the sense that it's the party who writes the rules in order to support their own position within the system. One other very significant thing to note here is the idea of Xi Jinping thought of socialist characteristics for a new era. Bart, could you unfold that idea? What is Xi Jinping thought and how is it shaping the current direction of Chinese governance?
Well, we see that in the history of the party that the major figures have all contributed their political philosophical concept to the party constitution. We have had the theory of Deng Xiaoping and the thought of Mao Zedong, and now we have the thought of Xi Jinping. So this is on the one hand showing indeed that party narratives and rhetorics are putting him in the same line, let's say, as Mao Zedong. But what is uncommon, let's say, is that till Xi Jinping, that this adagio was added to the party constitution posthumously, let's say, or at least when the people were no more politically active, while this is now during Xi Jinping's period in the presidency that his thought is being added. What is it? I think it's very difficult to unravel precisely what Xi Jinping thought all encompasses. But I think that you can see it also in line with other slogans, such as the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, common destiny for mankind, or common future for mankind. So all these kinds of slogans, which basically both once again have a domestic and an international claim to them. The great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation being very much a nationalistic kind of concept, which without really expressing it or defining it, harkens back to what is then called traditional Chinese values, and this has some notions that are similar to Confucianism, but I would not say that, you know, it is really, I mean, the reintroduction of Confucianism as such, but it are terms and concepts that somehow ring a bell, let's say, within the population. On the international level, well, it is indeed the case that economic power brings along with it also political influence, normative power, and that this Xi Jinping thought in this sense, in its international aspect, also refers to an increasing influence of China, especially, I would say, in what is then referred to as the Global South. We do indeed see how also trade of raw materials, of manufactured products of China or towards China with the Global South is increasing exponentially.
So if you have to put a label on Xi Jinping, what would you say he is? Is he a Marxist? Is he a Confucianist? Is he a Leninist?
Well, I would say that Chinese Communist Party has from the outset been based on Leninist structures. And I would say that in the Xi Jinping period, the Leninist element aspect within the Communist Party has been increased again.
Yes, yes, I very much agree to that. But you do see some of these elements of Marxist terms, new productive forces, for example, that it's kind of ideological in a way where you transform nature into something useful for the humans. So you have these ideas that start to be introduced. And I think that to some extent, Xi Jinping is definitely more ideological in this way, in framing his development strategy than previous administrations were. But let's talk about new productive forces and the economy for a little bit here in the end. China is facing a downturn and a crisis, some would say, and you do see people who argue on the one hand that this is a calculated, forced transition of the economy away from the heavy industry basis that was created back in the 50s, as Kelek argued a moment ago. And other people say things are spinning out of control. We are facing a real deep crisis. So where do you stand on that? Where does China stand economically?
Well, I think that the discussion on that is really complicated. I mean, for a while it seemed like China was growing out of the plan, to use a concept by Baron Norton, his book from 1995, that there was no blueprint, that there was this crossing the river by feeling for the stepping stone, so China would experiment a gradual incremental process, which was very different from the shock therapy in the former Soviet Union. And that seemed to be the case, but then in 2015, 2016, Xi Jinping at that time and his colleagues in the top leadership of Chinese Communist Party decided to implement what really looks like industrial policies in the form of these science and technology plans, very, very ambitious plan based on a lot of investment from the top on the development of science and technology, innovation and so on. And it seems that they are still adhering to that line, sort of moving away investment from infrastructure, from property development to these new sectors of the economy. And if that is the case, then it's a conscious shift to a new development mode away from the old strategy of focusing on heavy industry, developing, you know, industries which are now at high capacity, actually overcapacity. Now there appears to be this shift toward high quality production forces. And I think that has several dimensions, and we probably do not have time to go into this now. There's an ideological dimension, as Bart underlines, but there's also a foreign policy or global dimension, the pressure from the U.S., the U.S. attempt to cut off China from semiconductors, putting also pressure on the Taiwanese, and that is an existential crisis for China. So China is then reacting by this shift towards more science and technology-based development. And I think that in the mind of Xi Jinping, that is necessary. and he will do whatever it takes to maintain that position and that line, because that is an existential necessity for China in the current global situation, all that pressure that China is receiving from the US and its allies.
Yes, and I would add to that that there is also a very basic economic logic to that, in the sense that, as we have already mentioned, China's economic growth is going down and compared to the beginning years of opening up, which is a logical process, but also means, of course, I mean, Chinese welfare has gone up. People want, better wages. That means production costs go up. And if production costs go up, then, it's an economic law that then producers go elsewhere to where there are cheaper wages. And so China needs also more advanced products and needs to climb up on the production ladder just to maintain its economic value. And so it's also a mere economic, I would say, law that is playing there, that indeed every country needs to become more technologically sophisticated. And indeed, as Kjeld Erik says, if we see now the tensions and what that brings about between especially the United States and China, this is indeed almost an existential crisis for China, of course.
Yes, yes. And to some extent, to sum up this discussion, you could say that Xi Jinping perhaps sees a window of opportunity now of the next 10, 15 years where new technological standards will be set in place globally and in China. New industries will emerge that will define the future of the global economy. And if China is not on the top of that development, it will never become a high-income country. And that's the realization of the party. And I think what they are doing should be seen in relation to that overall trend.
Yes, and Xi Jinping will probably stay in power for the next 10 years to see it through.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, if not until his death. Who knows? I think with these words, our time is up for today. Thank you very much, Bart, for joining us online from Belgium. Thank you, Kjeld Erik Brusgaard, here in the studio. And we'll see you next time on this podcast.